This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lin Mark, Wang Xiaoning and Roshan Kanasan. It is 7.06 in the morning, Monday the 25th of November. And in about 15 minutes, we'll be speaking to Elina Noor, Associate Professor at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia-Pacific Centre for Security Studies on Malaysia's foreign policy. But before that, here are the markets.
So on Friday, Asian markets were mostly in the green. The Hang Seng closed up at 0.5%. The Shanghai closed down about 0.6. Nikkei was, and Kospi were up about 0.3. The Singapore STI was up 1%. And the KLCI was up about 0.3%. So overall, all green except for Shanghai.
Over in the US, the Dow was up 0.4%. S&P 500 up 0.2%, which was also the same for the Nasdaq.
So joining us this morning on the line for some thoughts on global markets, we have Stephen Innes, Asia-Pacific market strategist at Axie Trader. Thank you for joining us, Stephen. Now, the Hang Seng Index has just celebrated its 50th birthday, generating a return of 16,700% since 1969. But with the continued protests, as well as concerns of the erosion of basic law in Hong Kong, is the best over for this leading Asian bourse?
It's very difficult to tell how this narrative is going to evolve. Obviously, the way we're looking at it right now, it's quite contentious because we have, you know, the U.S. backing the support for the protests. But, you know, we're waiting to see what type of reprisal is going to come back from mainland China. Of course, the greater concern is if we have a continued escalation of this mobocracy, which really ultimately and at some point possibly could trigger troops coming in from Shenzhen. And this is really what's worrying the market. But, you know, beyond the market implications here, you have to assume that some backroom, boardroom discussions are going on about relocations. And this is the problem. It's whether that businesses perceive Hong Kong as a viable center for doing business, especially in the banking sector. I have to remember a lot of expatriates are hired by foreign and local banks to work in Hong Kong. And we look at jobs these days. They're pretty fluid. You don't really necessarily have to stay in the same city. Job location is pretty agnostic. You can really locate anywhere. So unless you're a front-facing client interface person, you can basically live anywhere in Asia and still conduct business. So this is where the concerns are lying, in my view.
And Stephen, let's stay in Asia in particular. Let's take a look at Malaysia. The ringgit has swung between 4.2 and 4.12 against the dollar in the last 2 weeks, and it closed at 4.17 on Friday. What's the reason for this volatility? Is it the US dollar strengthening or the ringgit weakening?
Yeah, well, you know, it was a pretty depressing week for the ringgit, as it was the rest of the Asian basket. If we take things into context here, all the currencies weakened. I think this is really revolving around the much-discussed face-to-face between the U.S. and China and whether it's going to take place before December 15th. I think there's some doubt leading into this discussion, because obviously that December 15th date is thought to be the date where the U.S. is scheduled to impose more tariffs. So here's the thing. We're getting into this seasonality play where investors tend to like to hedge into the U.S. dollar going into year end. That's also weighing negatively, but we're also seeing a propensity for traders and investors to hedge their Asia currency risks going into year end. Remember, you know, although we're not in the same situation as we were back in 2018, investors are still nervous we could have a repeat. So there is some currency hedging going on. This would actually play out negatively anyway. So I think we're seeing a combination of both trade talk jitters along with the natural propensity to hedge into year end affecting the Malaysian ringgit a little bit earlier than normal, but it's starting to play into the hedging is starting to play into consideration now.
And Stephen, since you mentioned trade talks, let's have a little bit of a discussion on the U.S.-China trade talks. And a meeting between Trump and Xi Jinping supposed to take place before the December 15 tariffs kick in. Do you think realistically that date will be met? Can we sign a phase one of a trade deal by then?
You know, I don't think it's a bridge too far, really. I mean, you just have to put a date, a timeline, and agree on a location. I mean, we can go on to Expedia and do that ourselves every day. Why can't these leaders go in and set up a timetable and get things organized? Okay, I'm making it sound a little bit more simplistic. Of course, security concerns and what have you would have to be arranged. That's the problem, is the security arrangements. Can we make those arrangements quick enough? There is some thought here that you know, if they can't come together, there's possibility that the U.S. can defer the tariffs. Makes sense. If they can't meet that timeline, but that's a big if. Nonetheless, the closer we get to December, the more worrisome traders will become that perhaps they're not going to see eye to eye, perhaps that the December 15 tariffs are going to be imposed, and perhaps that could derail phase one of the trade talks. These are the issues we're going to deal with. And this week, in my view, is a fairly critical week, despite the fact that it's holiday shortened, even sort of condenses that into the first few days of the week. We're hoping that we get some sort of concession offered up between now and perhaps Wednesday before we head into the Thursday U.S. Thanksgiving holiday period.
And Stephen, moving on to gold, it has sharply corrected from the month high of $1,502 per ounce to close at $1,461. There appears to be a strong price correlation over the last 2 years between the Fed rates and gold prices. So with a rate pause, what are your expectations for gold prices going forward?
You hit the nail on the head. That's exactly it. I mean, you know, sure, trade headlines are going to create a little bit of noise up and down. We're going to trade within that $15 to $20 range that we get driven on headline hysteria, so I'm referring to it. But ultimately, gold really comes down to our real interest rates and primarily what the Federal Reserve Board is doing. We noticed since the Fed went on pause, bond yields went higher. And obviously, bond yields are such a bigger, much more massive market and appeals to a broader asset investor base. So bonds have, you know, as they nudged towards 1.95 to 2% level last week, we saw duration coming back into the fold. So investors actually do prefer to own bonds rather than gold, especially when you get closer to 2%. So yes, going forward, the key narrative is really the Fed, U.S. dollar, and bond yields. Now, looking at the data that we've had over the past month, it sort of supports the fact that the Feds are on pause. It's been very strong. And this suggests to me that the Feds are not going to move anywhere near that rate cut lever anytime soon. But I don't think it's smart to get overly complacent because this data can shift pretty substantially. But I don't think it's going to shift enough to create a Fed to cut interest rates in 2019. And I'd be really surprised if they're going to pull the rate cut lever anytime soon in 2020 either. So I agree. I think gold would remain under pressure. Listen, it's a great defensive strategy, but it might not be the so-called trade of the century, the way things are shaping up now.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen. And that was Stephen Innes, Asia-Pacific market strategist at Axie Trader, with his thoughts on gold and the Fed, as well as US-China trade talks and the situation over in Hong Kong. But taking a look at some international headlines this morning, Michael Bloomberg has just officially announced that he is running for president. So this will put him against other Democrats vying to take on Donald Trump in 2020. And he made the statement last Sunday that he was running for president to defeat Trump and I quote, rebuild America.
Yeah, there was a lot of nice phrasing in his statement, right? So Bloomberg said that his unique set of experiences in business, government and philanthropy would enable him to win and lead. And that's really what it comes down to, right? The Democrats need to find someone who can beat Donald Trump in 2020. Right now, the front runners are all in their 70s. You've got Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. The youngest among them is Elizabeth Warren, who is 70 years old. Biden and Sanders are in their late 70s, and Bloomberg is going to be joining them in that rank, 77 years old, vying for a spot on the Democratic ticket amongst 18 other nominations.
Yeah, but there have been some criticisms against Bloomberg's campaign, right? Many of the Bloomberg's more left-leaning rivals were outraged over the fact that he has already spent $30 million on Friday for a single week of television ads promoting his campaign. Warren said the advertising buy was one way to pay less under her proposed wealth tax.
So Bloomberg has said that he won't be accepting any political donations to his campaign, which would preclude him from participating in Democratic National Committee debates, which require candidates to have a certain number of individual donors in order to take part. And he's also said that if he is elected president, he will work for just $1 a year. So another very interesting addition to the Democratic race over in the US. But right now we are heading into a few messages. And after that, we'll be speaking with Alina Noor, Associate Professor at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies on Malaysia's foreign policy. So be sure to stay tuned for that. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.